Hello and welcome to Martian Drive-In Podcast number 59. My name is Terry Frost, and this time around, doing two really, really different films. First one is one of our subscribers' choices, which was the 1960 Ray Harryhausen special effects Jules Verne adaptation, Mysterious Island, starring Michael Craig and Joan Greenwood. And then we go to 2014 for an Australian zombie movie you may or may not have heard about, but which is a lot of fun. And that is Wormwood, which it's kind of Mad Maxi and kind of zombie at the same time. It's a lot of fun. The Martian Drive-In Podcast appears every 2 weeks and is a podcast of science fiction, horror, and fantasy movie appreciation. It doesn't matter what it is. It could be all the way from George Méliès through to Michael Bay, though I'm not likely to do Michael Bay. But feedback is important to me. So if you want to leave some feedback, you can leave it at cultguru, K-U-L-T-G-U-R-U, at gmail.com. You can leave it at the Martian Drive-In Podcast website, marsdrivein.blogspot.com. The other thing you can do is go over to the Paleo Cinema Cafe on Facebook. So if you type in Paleo-Cinema Cafe into Facebook, you can go and leave some feedback there as well. Now, there are occasionally adult concepts in this podcast, so just keep that in mind as you listen, and sit back and enjoy the rest of the show. Hey, how's everybody going? Yes, I have seen Age of Ultron, so I'll say that right up front. Saw it yesterday, 3D with the cronies, and I enjoyed it, but I'm not going to talk about it on the podcast yet. And the reason for that is pretty simple, and this is a bit of a big announcement. The Martian Drive-In Podcast is going to record a live episode at Continuum, the local Melbourne science fiction convention, in June this year. I'm getting Grant Watson and Sonia Marcon to be on the podcast, and we're going to talk all the way through Age of Ultron and whatever else comes up. In that regard, it's going to be done in front of a live studio audience, well, a live convention audience at least. And we've got about 2 hours to play with, so we've got plenty of time to kind of digest Age of Ultron and the good bits, the bad bits, what works, what doesn't, where Marvel's going next and all that kind of shit. So I'm saving that one because that's going to be big, and it's something I've wanted to do for a few years. And Grant said, why aren't you doing that? And I went, okay, I'll do it. So I approached the organisers of Continuum, who were always looking for content, and suggested that I do it, and they immediately came back to me and said, yep, do you want 1 or 2 hours? So I said 2 hours is nice, and they're giving me 2 hours. Other podcasts have recorded at Continuum, and Continuum is very friendly to podcasters, which I'm very grateful for, of course, and I'm looking forward to it. I don't know whether it's going to get many more ears listening to the podcast, but it doesn't hurt to get the word out there locally, and yep, so I'm going to do that. I'll promise to try not to swear more than I absolutely have to, though that could happen. And if you go into Continuum, please hang out. Come to the live recording, see all the ums and ahs that I normally cut out of the podcast, and enjoy yourself, and just stop by to say hello. So the two movies to talk about this time, we've got Mysterious Island, a Cy Enfield movie produced by Charles Schneer, and starring Michael Craig, Michael Callan, Joan Greenwood, Herbert Lom playing Captain Nemo, and a few Ray Harryhausen creatures. So that's the first movie, and the second one is Wormwood, Road of the Dead from 2014, an Australian indie horror film, which was made for $160,000 with some deferred payments as well, and ended up, after it was released for a week in Australia, being the most torrented movie in Australia, which kind of pissed off the makers of the movie, and rightly so too. I've actually forked out for the Blu-ray because I wanted to support these guys. And it's a really interesting horror movie. It actually brings in a couple of new twists to the zombie thing, which needs new twists, of course, being almost a cliche and near ubiquitous at the moment. So I thought I'd throw that one in too to see if I can get some more people to actually, and I'm encouraging this for the first time ever in the podcast, to actually fork out and pay for a copy of this movie, or pay to stream it, or pay for it through some kind of video on demand service. But anyway, first off, we go to the usual, which is stuff what I have been watching. been on a little bit of a John Carpenter roll lately. So I've watched two John Carpenter genre films. First one being They Live with Roddy Piper and Keith David in it. And then Escape from New York. I just finished watching that very recently. In fact, in the last hour, with Kurt Russell, of course, Lee Van Cleef, and Adrian Barbeau. So, yeah, I kind of enjoyed both of those. I like John Carpenter's stuff. I even like Ghosts of Mars and the weird stuff he did there. But, yeah, so that was just a bit of a chill out. Then I went to one of my all-time favourites, which is the Vincente Minnelli movie from 1962, 2 Weeks in Another Town, starring Kirk Douglas, Edward G. Robinson, Sid Charisse, Dahlia Lavi, and a bunch of other people, and I really like that. It's a good companion movie on a double bill with La Dolce Vita, though La Dolce Vita is a long film, so it's going to be a very long double feature if you decide to watch that, but I enjoyed it still, like my stories of redemption and having a good time with that. I did see two kind of bad Nicolas Cage movies, which can be oxymoronic, but he has done some good films in his day. And the first one was Next, that one where he plays the guy who can see a couple of minutes into the future. And then a really bad kind of horror movie from a year or so ago called the Tokarev, or Rage, about a retired gangster whose daughter gets killed. And he goes on a rampage in New Orleans and does all sorts of things. It's got Danny Glover and a bunch of other people in it, and it's not really good. So I saw that. I did watch a movie for the radio. The thing I do with Liz Travaskis on ABC Local Radio in the Northern Territory. We decided to do the Sally Potter movie from 1992, I think it is, Orlando, starring Tilda Swinton and Billy Zane. And, you know, there's a bit of gender bending in that movie. It's a lot of fun. It's wry. There's a bit of talking to the camera. And both of us enjoyed it. I picked it up very cheaply on Blu-ray, so I thought I'd suggest it to Liz. And she responded very well, and she enjoyed it. The only other thing I really want to mention that I've seen is a documentary about 3D printing called Print the Legend. It's about a number of different companies that are trying to be the leader in the business, and it goes through the various characters at the top of the companies and takes a look at them. And yeah, it's a good overview of 3D printing. Sal's looking at possibly getting a 3D printer at some stage, so we looked at that as a little bit of a eye-opener and to get a little more information. But it's a well put together little documentary, and it does concentrate more on this 3D printing industry as a startup rather than the technology itself. The technology is, of course, part of it, but it's more about the changes the companies and the people go through when they're putting together these companies, the rapid expansion, the changing offices, the change in the corporate culture for the startups, and the way that real-world problems impact the way that people do various parts of what they're doing. MakerBot's the one that's mainly emphasized. That started out as open source and then went to proprietary because they had some supporters that they really needed to keep happy, and that was their option not to make it open source anymore, and that alienated a number of people in the industry and who were fans of the company. And yes, companies like that do have fans. And so there's a great big story arc there, and it really is a nice even-headed overview of a sunrise industry which is going to only get bigger and bigger as time goes on. So I enjoyed that as well. That was on Netflix, which I'm keeping, by the way. Netflix in Australia is about a month old today, and I'm keeping Netflix because I enjoy it. It's easy to access. It doesn't buffer much on my connection. And we've got it in two rooms. In fact, we've got another Chromecast, so I can put it on in the other room so Sal can watch it and I can watch it, and it doesn't seem to be any problem when we're doing that. But anyway, it's probably time we got on with the actual movies I'm going to talk about in the podcast. And here's the trailer for the first one, Mysterious Island, from 1961.
Whatever you have imagined in your wildest dreams now becomes a visual reality. As Jules Verne's most fantastic adventure in space and time becomes an amazing film experience.
How many more? Lighten the basket, we gotta gain height.
Verne, the man whose great stories inspired such unusual films as Around the World in 80 Days, 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, journey to the center of the Earth surpasses them all with Mysterious Island. Starring Michael Craig, who triggers the screen's most thrilling escape. Gary Merrill as a war correspondent. Joan Greenwood, shipwrecked on the Mysterious Island. And in this story of survival, Michael Callan and Beth Rogan.
Come on.
What's it doing?
I don't know.
Sealing us in.
Also starring Herbert Lom as the mysterious Captain Nemo and his fabulous submarine, the Nautilus.
Aren't we able to do anything to save ourselves?
Nothing that can be done.
Super Dynamation, newest and greatest screen process, astonishes the eye with such scenes as the fight to the death with a prehistoric devilfish, the discovery and destruction of an underwater city, Mysterious Island, photographed on land, under the sea, and in the air. Truly a first in motion pictures.
Mysterious Island is a 1961 English film. It was made in England with an American producer and an American director, based on the story Mysterious Island by Jules Verne. The cast is kind of interesting, but not necessarily for fantastic reasons. Michael Craig plays Captain Cyrus Harding, a Union soldier. John Greenwood plays Lady Mary Fairchild, who's an aristocrat washed up on the island. Michael Callan plays Herbert Brown, another soldier. Gary Merrill plays Gideon Split, who is a journalist. Herbert Lom plays Captain Nemo. Beth Rogan plays Elena Fairchild, Lady Mary's niece. And we have Percy Herbert as Sergeant Pencroft. This movie was selected by Paul White, one of the Patreon subscribers to the podcast. And Paul's done fantastic things for both podcasts over the years because he started the Letterboxd page, which will show a graphic version of all of the movies that Paleo Cinema and the Martian Drive-In podcast have discussed. It's a hell of a lot of work, and Paul's done it with very little thanks. And then he goes and gives me money for the podcast as well. So I'm glad that I've been able to do a movie for you, Paul, but I'm not sure you're going to like all of what I say about the movie. I'm going to be honest with you, it's not my favourite Ray Harryhausen movie, but I will give reasons why. And to start off with, I'll address the Ray Harryhausen part. Ray Harryhausen, incredible artist, incredible craftsman, apparently a really nice guy as well. And the monsters he does with this film are pretty spectacular. There's a giant crab, which they made out of a real crab's shell. There's a giant flightless bird, and I've got to get this name right because I know people will pick me up on it if I don't. The giant bird is a Forest Ruckus, which is a giant extinct predatory bird that lived in Patagonia during the Miocene period, just so you know. He does a really nice one of that. And I've taken a look at more recent drawings of a Forest Ruckus. And, yeah, it's pretty damn accurate. You know how sometimes you see dinosaurs and megafauna, and the pictures you get from, say, 1940s, 1950s, 1960s look nothing like the things really were? This one is fairly accurate. Even though it does look like a giant chicken, it's fairly realistic to what the flightless bird was actually supposed to have been like. So all credit to Ray Harryhausen there. He then goes on and has giant bees. Now, we all know that giant bees can't exist because they can't breathe through their spiracles, and a giant flying bee is just not on because of basically science, basically physics, and basically it does look good though. So there's that as well. There's a giant cephalopod as well, which the people see underneath the ocean and have a bit of a fight with using Captain Nemo's electric lightning guns, which is kind of cool, although that one doesn't get as much visibility as the other monsters. So just to settle all of that, Ray Harryhausen really interesting and fantastic work in this movie, and he really did bring out his A-game. He did a good job of the thing, even though the monsters aren't in the movie a terribly long amounts of time. They are done very well. Now, before I go and criticise other aspects of the movie, I will be up front and say, yes, I realise that this is a 1960 movie intended for children, pretty much, and therefore the expectations as far as certain kinds of artistry in the movie industry are kind of limited. Now, having said that, this is what I observed watching the movie again. The monsters, Ray Harryhausen's beautiful, wonderful, creative, realistic monsters, are totally superfluous to this movie. They don't actually need to be there for any plot reason at all, except to be something of danger to the people. As if surviving on a desert island isn't dangerous enough, these wonderful, miraculous beasties just simply don't need to be there. In fact, during production, there was talk about not using them and not having the monsters in there and just having it, you know, people surviving on an island, meeting Captain Nemo, a pirate ship comes up, the volcano's blowing up, they've got to get back off the island, all of that kind of stuff. That may have worked well in the right hands. And to be honest with you, Cy Enfield was the right hands a few years later, where he did another tale of survival about 5 years after this, a classic movie that I love like Vegemite, which is Sands of the Kalahari with Stanley Baker and Stuart Whitman in it. That movie, that gets right what he doesn't get right in this film. And that's kind of interesting to me. So then we get to the cast. Michael Craig later went on to have a long career in a number of films. He was in the Joseph Losey adaptation of Modesty Blaze. He was in a very well-known and very well-loved Brian Trenchard-Smith movie, Turkey Shoot, playing the camp commandant. So he moved to Australia and went on to have a distinguished career, mostly on television here, but you know, he went on to do some good work. But in this, he's kind of hampered in several ways. First off, every single role in the movie is underwritten, and that's kind of unfortunate, though Herbert Lom does give it a tremendous effort and does a fantastic Captain Nemo, and he does give you the gravitas and the kind of weirdness of Captain Nemo quite effectively, given the underwritten script. But yeah, the scripts are underwritten for a start, but Michael Craig in particular, he's an Englishman, and his American accent kind of comes and goes. And I always liked seeing that in a movie, though. I found it annoying in this one for some reason. Again, Percy Herbert was playing a southerner in the movie, and he's an English actor known for playing kind of sergeants in various movies and various army kind of personnel. And Percy Herbert's accent is even more ropey than Michael Craig's. And then we get on to the ingenues, and that's where we kind of lose things a little bit, which is a shame. I mean, I'd like to like this movie more than I do. We've got Michael Callan, a very kind of B-movie actor, never very good in anything, playing Herbert Brown. He's supposed to be the love interest. Funny thing is, he's on a desert island, always seems to be able to find hair gel. It's one of those kind of roles where he's the only person in there with perfectly coiffed hair, which is kind of stupid, but, you know, that's what movies are like then. Then we have Beth Rogen playing Elena, and Beth Rogen was a starlet, but unfortunately she really doesn't project well on the screen. She's got a nice little body, and she's quite cute to look at, but her skills aren't up to even this kind of role, and that's really kind of sad and unfortunate. We've also got Dan Jackson, a Barbadian actor, playing Corporal Neb Nugent. Well, he's named Nugent when he's a black actor, but he does a pretty good job of it as well, though I kept expecting him to die because it's always the black guy that dies in these movies, but it turns out it wasn't. It was Captain Nemo. But it's nice to see a black guy survive till the end of one of these kind of movies. So all credit to Cy Enfield for this. And then we have Joan Greenwood playing Lady Mary. And Joan Greenwood, the best description of her voice I've heard is that she has a feline, plummy accent. She's a very kind of upper-class English accent. And Joan Greenwood, I like her in a lot of different things. She was the love interest in The Man in the White Suit with Alec Guinness about a decade before. And she was married right up until his death to a favourite of mine from various Hammer horror films and other horror movies of the era. And that is Andre Morel. She was married to Andre Morel for a very long time. And they had a fantastic marriage together by all the information I can get together. And, I like Jaron Greenwood, but in this one, again, she doesn't get much to do apart from making clothing for everybody out of goat skins and other domestic chores, which is a shame because Jaron Greenwood was always a kind of forceful personality in movies, and in this one she's kind of wasted. It's very much a role that didn't need somebody of her talents, and particularly of her beauty, in a sense, where you think, I mean, I'm watching the movie and I'm a guy in his 50s, and I'm thinking, well, you know, the young woman looks kind of cute, but Jaron Greenwood definitely is a lot sexier than she is. So, but maybe that's the perspective of my age, but that's how I saw it at the time I was watching this. Now, Cy Enfield, the director, as I said, he's directed other things. He did Zulu, he produced Zulu Dawn, he did Sands of the Kalahari and a number of other films. Cy Enfield was called out by the House Un-American Activities Committee as a communist and he fled the United States for England and then started his career again there. He did a number of films where he used pseudonyms so that the movies could be sold in American markets. And then in 1957 he did a fantastic gritty little truck driving crime drama called Hell Drivers, which had a cast that will blow you away. It had Herbert Lom in it, who plays Captain Nemo in this film, Patrick McGoohan, Sean Connery, Stanley Baker, William Hartnell, Gordon Jackson, David McCullum, Jill Ireland. It just had a fantastic cast, and it's a really nice little drama. If you haven't seen Hell Drivers, see it. Cy Enfield knew how to make a decent movie. But this isn't it. But anyway, I should have gone through the plot synopsis of this film. I apologise that I haven't yet. I'm getting passionate in the fact that this is a missed opportunity, but I'll calm down now and I'll go ahead. Basically, a bunch of Union soldiers in a Confederate prison during the Civil War escape via a helium balloon from the prison, taking along with them one of their prison guards who knows how to use the balloon. They get caught in a major storm, the biggest storm that's been seen right up until the point where George Clooney on that boat full of fishermen got killed. They get swept right across America and out into the Pacific Ocean and end up, the balloon ends up tearing and falling into the ocean right near an island where it happens that Captain Nemo is holed up. The Nautilus has been pretty much wrecked. It's still running, but barely. It can't move. And he's decided that what he's going to do with his time on the island is create giant animals in order to avoid future wars by giving everybody enough to eat, by breeding giant prehistoric chickens, giant crabs, giant bees, and giant cephalopods. Not the best thought out plan, I'll give him that, but this is what we've got in the movie. So for most of the film, the people on the island know somebody's helping them, but they can't really figure out who. There's a lot of survival stuff, lassoing wild goats and working out how to get a food and a water supply, eating oyster stew made out of the giant oysters that grow on the islands and all sorts of things like that. And then they meet Captain Nemo just as two things happen. A pirate ship's about to reach the island and they're endangered by the pirates. And, of course, the obligatory volcano is about to turn the whole thing into Krakatoa east of Java. That's it. That's the lot of it. Now, it's an old-fashioned adventure movie. It's a little bit like The Lost World, which happened about a year before that. The effects are much better than The Lost World. Particularly the lava effects and the volcanic effects and the explosions are pretty good in this movie. So I will give it that from a craft standpoint. Between Harryhausen's monsters and the explosions and lava stuff, whether that was footage stolen from another movie, I don't know. But it's all pretty good stuff. But the problem is that a lot of the characters aren't very engaging. And one of the things you've got to have in this movie is interesting and fun characters. And for the most part, they're not. The only two interesting characters I've found, too, and yeah, again, the roles are very, very underwritten, is Gary Merrill playing the journalist. I think he's kind of cool. He really does try to lift the material more than the other actors do. and all credit to him for that. I like Gary Merrill for a number of reasons. I think he was a good character actor. He's also in one of the best movies of all time, All About Eve, playing the love interest for Betty Davis, whom he later married. And he's quite good in there. He's got a kind of weathered, intelligent face and a nice way of putting the script across. And I like him in this film as well. He's believable as a journalist of the time, and he's got a little bit of perspective and a little bit of wisdom that some of the other characters lack. And the other person, of course, is Joan Greenwood, who does, in her own way, as Gary Merrill does, tries to lift the material, but the scripts are all a bit banal. The plotting isn't bad. I mean, the whole story from the Confederate escape through to the jumping on the island and the survival stuff and all that, there's nothing bad there, but the dialogue is a little bit flat. Yes, I'm looking at it from a perspective of 55 years on, but one of the things that makes one of these type of movies pop, apart from the special effects, the Harryhausen special effects, is if you can make the dialogue really interesting and a lot of fun. And this movie just fails on that regard. Like I said, it's of its time, but I don't think it's the best of its time. It's kind of mediocre in that way. And I was just reading John Brosnan's review of it in Future Shock, his book about the history of science fiction movies. And pretty much he says it's an okay thing. Good tight direction by Cy Enfield and a better than average script by John Preble, Daniel Ullman and Crane Wilbur. So it's kind of damning with faint praise, and I think that's about right for this one. It's one of those movies, and this is a phenomenon that fascinates me, and I probably will fascinate me, and I'll never quite understand why it is so. But here it is. If you see a movie when you're a kid, maybe up until the age of about 12 years old, if you see a genre movie for some kind at that perfect sweet spot age, say from 5 till 12, then regardless of how you see the movie afterwards, you're going to love it. It's the reason why Star Wars is so popular. One of the waves of the baby boom just crested over Star Wars, and a ton of people saw it when they were at a very impressionable age. And like Catholicism, belief in the movie is stuck. And so that's why Star Wars has got all these new iterations and why everybody's wetting themselves about seeing Han Solo and Chewbacca in the Millennium Falcon again in the trailer for the new Star Wars movie and all of that kind of stuff. But there's a weird kind of indoctrination that happens to all of us. It happened to me with Valley of Guanji and other films like that that I love, even though I can see the flaws in them and can see the little inconsistencies in the special effects and all that kind of stuff. There's a really odd sweet spot there where we become uncritically in love with certain movies because we saw them at just that right age. And for Paul White, I know this because he told me in a note he sent me, this is one of those movies that hit that sweet spot for him. And so I'm not trying to dissuade you from liking the movie, Paul, but that's just my observations of it. I think that from a craft point of view and from Harryhausen point of view, it's all right up there. But there are bits of it I wanted to be better. And maybe that's an indication, too, that I kind of like the film. Sometimes you see a movie and you want it to be better. You want the dialogue to be better. You want the characters to be better written. You want things to be a little sharper. You want Herbert Lom to be given more cool stuff to do as Captain Nemo. Maybe I do like the movie from that point of view. Probably the worst thing with a movie is when it does have that flat dialogue and the underwritten characters and all that, and you don't give a shit. I think that would be the death knell for a movie, when you just don't care enough to want it to be better. But this is a movie that I do want it to be better than it was. And it is, I think it's a lesser Harryhausen, I'll be honest with you. I think Harryhausen's work had more support in other films before and after this movie. But again, it's of its time, and it's an honest effort. They were trying to do something that not many other people in Hollywood and in England at the time were trying to do, and we've got to give them some level of credit for that. So there's not too much else to say about Mysterious Island. There have been another number of other versions of it as movies and television, so that's kind of cool. There's a 1916 adaptation of 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, which used a little bit of the Mysterious Island plot for it. There's a 1929 film, which was directed partly by Jacques Tourneur's father, Maurice Tourneur, which is kind of cool. American all-color 5-part talking feature. It survives only in the black and white form, with talking sequences, sound effects, and synchronized music. I'm reading this off Wikipedia. There was a 1941 Russian version, which would be very interesting to see. There was a 1951 version, which is something I didn't know about before I started researching this one. And I'm just loading the information about that because I want to see whether it was at all interesting. It was actually a movie serial, one of those Columbia serials from the time, which I'm going to have to try to track down a copy of now, because apart from anything else, if you look up Mysterious Island serial in Wikipedia, I'm not going to tell you who it is, but you're going to see a very familiar name about halfway down the cast list. I'm going to leave that one as an exercise for the students. But it'd be fun to see that one. And there have been a number of other adaptations. I'm just trying to find them right now. As there was that 1961 version, of course. There was a 1967 live-action animated one called The Stolen Airship, based loosely on Mysterious Island. There was a TV version of it called L'Île Mystérieuse in 1972, featuring Omar Sharif as Captain Nemo. There was a Canadian TV series that ran for one season in 1995, a 2005 TV movie starring Patrick Stewart as Captain Nemo. There were those two movies with Brendan Fraser and Dwayne Johnson from a few years ago. And there's a 2012 cinematic adaptation made for the Sci-Fi Channel, which starred absolutely nobody of any real talent apart from Pruitt Taylor Vincent, which I know nothing about, but I'm going to have to now check it out, I suppose. From the look of things, it was very low budget and may not have been a very interesting adaptation of the stuff. Now, before I take a break, there is the Patreon campaign birthday raffle, which I've promised the people who donated to the Patreon campaign that I would get together a box of movies and movie-related stuff to give to one of the Patreon subscribers who supported the podcast. Now, I've done that. I've got a box of cool stuff here. Some serious movies, some genre films, some movie memorabilia, some bits and pieces of stuff. And the winner of that particular little box of wonderfulness is Grant Watson. I've pulled Grant's name out of the hat, and Grant Watson has it. I'm going to arrange to get Grant that box. Fortunately, he lives in Melbourne, so it's not going to cost me a fortune to mail it off. And I will be doing that again next year. Over the next 12 months, I'll be getting movies together, and I will be putting together another box to be given out on or around my birthday in April 2016. So if you want to be in for that one, you've got to go to patreon.com/paleocinema and start donating. Anyway, I'm going to take that break. Now, when we get back, I'm going to talk about an Australian movie that started out as part of an Indiegogo campaign. And it is 2014's Wormwood Road of the Dead, a good little Australian zombie movie, which I found really interesting for a number of reasons. So I'm going to take a break now. And when I get back, we're going to hit the road with some zombies.
All we know is there is something in the air that's changing people.
I need you to get me to Bulla Bulla.
Why? You're getting sister.
Ready?
Born ready.
Come on, you dead bastard!
The medical box.
Open it!
Oh, beers!
You want a beer, Frank?
What do you fucking reckon?
Tell me where she is.
This truck runs on zombies. No zombies, no truck.
You get to see what the adults do after dark.
Oi! Can we come inside? There's fucking zombies everywhere!
Yeah, guy.
Zombies!
We need fuel.
There's no way that could work.
There's one way to find out.
We need to armor up. Big time.
It's about the survival of the human fucking race, mate. Hold on!
Come on, you zombie!
You want a zombie? I'll get you a zombie. What?
Round them or through them?
Through them.
Doing something new with zombie movies is kind of difficult. There have been so many iterations of it. I mean, the first zombie movie I ever saw was an old 1957 Sam Katzman cheapy movie called Zombies of Muratau, which I've actually got a copy of now, and I'll go back and revisit. It had Alison Hayes in it, which was kind of nice, but the zombies in this movie are slow-moving, kind of chunky American actors dressed up like merchant seamen who'd come out of the water and kill people and are basically there to guard a fortune in diamonds, which are in a sunken ship. As you do, because of course we all know that zombies hate capitalism. Watching that movie now, it's not scary at all, but at the time, when I was a little kid, I actually saw it at my grandparents' house down in Hammondville in Sydney. And it scared the shit out of me at the time because these dead people were walking around and that was an innately scary thing to me. But we've moved on since then and zombies have evolved. We've had fast zombies, slow zombies. We've had bits and pieces of zombies cut off. We've had Walking Dead, which started out with the hero shooting a little girl zombie in the head. And it's become a growth industry in a lot of ways, kind of the same way that during a zombie apocalypse, zombies become a growth industry. But Wormwood, Road of the Dead, does do a couple of new and neat things with zombies. It doesn't just do one new and neat thing, it does two at least. And that's kind of cool. The movie was done on a $160,000 budget, which is not a lot of money even here. And in fact, they had to do an Indiegogo campaign to finish the production of it, do all the post-production work. And then, they got a release in one cinema, and it got some pretty good reviews. And then it became the most torrented movie for a while in Australia and around the world as well. It became viral, but the people who had spent, and no kidding, they did 4 years making this movie. And then everybody stole it on BitTorrent, which is kind of a shame. I mean, I use BitTorrent, I'll be honest with you, I do use BitTorrent. But these guys spent 4 years working every weekend to do this movie. It was only done on weekends because that's the time they had spare. And they scraped together help from everybody they knew. They caught in some debts. They got into debt. They did a whole bunch of things. And then suddenly, as the movie gets released, after this long, long time, they didn't do too well out of it. Now, that's a shame because it's a good zombie movie. And I want to encourage the makers of this film, who are, and I've got to name check them because these guys did fantastically good work. And they're kind of brothers, like the Sperry brothers who did Undead about a decade and a half ago. And they are Kaya Roach Turner and his brother Tristan Roach Turner. And this was kind of something that they wanted to do. They had the script together, they had people together. And they did better than I would have expected had you just told me these guys were making a zombie movie for 4 years on weekends on a budget that wouldn't buy you a house in a dying country town. But I like this movie, and I was surprised at how good it was when I saw it. And right in my left hand, which is a contradiction in terms, I have the Blu-ray of it, and with the Blu-ray they give you a digital copy as well. And I'm glad I bought it. I really do want to support these guys. I like to support local genre filmmakers where I can. So what I'm saying before I review this movie is, if you like what you hear and you want to check the movie out, please either watch it on a streaming video service or pay for a download or pay for a disc and watch it that way. I don't normally say that, but in this case, because of that hard work that didn't get the Turner Brothers too much reward, I'm saying it now, pay for this movie. Okay, here's the synopsis from IMDb, which is not a bad one because it was written by Kaya Roach Turner and Tristan Roach Turner. Barry is a talented mechanic and family man whose life is torn apart on the eve of a zombie apocalypse. Well, it's torn apart just as the apocalypse starts. His sister Brooke is kidnapped by a sinister team of gas mask-wearing soldiers, and she's experimented on by a psychotic doctor. While Brooke plans her escape, Barry goes out on the road to find her and teams up with Benny, a fellow survivor, and together they must arm themselves and prepare to battle their way through hordes of flesh-eating monsters in a harsh Australian bushland. Which is pretty much it, but it's more complicated than that. There's more to it than that. And it is a lot of fun, this movie. It's got humour. It's got some really nice digital and practical effects. It's got a couple of twists on zombies, which are kind of cool and very, very apt for an Australian zombie movie. And it has some moments of genuine horror and does those moments really well. Blending horror and comedy is always a tough ask, but this movie does it with a great deal of skill and a great deal of wisdom. I suppose when you've got 4 years to do the production of a movie, you do get time to think things through, and that very much shows that the production time, even though it may have been a pain for these guys, really did help out a lot. Now, the cast is pretty good. There's only one actor in the movie that I've seen in a previous film, but they're all really good at what they do. We've got Jay Gallagher playing Barry, who's a bearded tradesman. It's a very working class movie as well, I should say that. There aren't too many posh people in this film. It's very much an Australian country story. So the people who appear in the movie are overall working class kind of people, apart from the scientist and a couple of other people. It is very much a blue-collar movie. You've got Jay Gallagher, he plays Barry, and he's really good. He's got the looks for... he's kind of reminded me in a lot of ways, and this is probably not entirely accidental, of a young Bruce Campbell. He's got that kind of look about him. And he does some very, very tough emotional scenes very well as well. He's really got some range as an actor. And I liked him playing Barry. And in the sense, he's the through line for the movie. He's the person you start out with and follow all the way through the thing. Then we have Bianca Brady playing Brooke, his sister, who's kidnapped and experimented on by the scientists. Now, in this zombie apocalypse, the only people immune to whatever's causing the zombie contagion, which comes down in meteorites very much in the same way they did in Undead, the only thing that stops you being mutated by it is if you've got A negative blood type, which leaves me out because I've got A positive blood type. But it's a nice conceit, and it gives a kind of scientific rationale for why certain people aren't affected by the zombie mutation. So 6% of the population aren't going to turn into zombies. I checked that out, by the way. I did my Google search, and 6% of the population have A negative blood type. I've got the second most common blood type, but then the fact that I'm very common is a surprise to nobody. But leaving this, the rationale is pretty good, and it works well to serve the story, particularly with the scientists experimenting on Brooke and another guy and a bunch of zombies. Now, they're in a shipping container, and Brooke and the other living human are strapped to one wall of the shipping container. On the opposite wall of the shipping container are a bunch of zombies, and at the back of the shipping container is all the scientific equipment that this mad scientist in his hazmat suit is working on. And one of the first things he does is starts injecting zombie blood into Brooke in the back of her neck, probably in the cerebrospinal fluid, if I'm correct. To try to see whether she catches zombieism. So, yeah, he's doing more or less scientific study, but he's as mad as a cut snake and basically being supported by a bunch of, obviously, Australian soldiers who are wearing gas masks and other ways of protecting themselves from the contagion. So that's one side of things. And then the other side is Barry. Now, Barry's had a rough trot of things. His family got affected because they didn't have the same blood type as him. And he's had to kill both his wife and his daughter early in the film. And that's a harrowing piece of stuff. That's a little bit like The Mist. It's very much got the feel of The Mist, that movie where Thomas Jane has to do the same thing. And it works really well. And the dramatic tension is there. The direction is tight. And we get to like these characters before things go belly up in some very in a short period of time, which is kind of nice. They do essay the family life that Barry has before the zombie apocalypse in a really nice way, and that's all credit to the Roach Turner brothers. They've done a good job there. So, and then there's Barry's escape at night time, where everybody else around him is turning into a zombie. He's driving his truck down the street at night with zombies running at him from either side. And that works really well as well. I like the way it was done. I like the way it wasn't kind of overplayed, and the way that they used the limited budget, obviously the limited number of people in zombie makeup, to make it work. Having them kind of run from the sides and into the headlights and then bash against the side of the car really does work really well. And this is before any of the twists. We've got, right up to this time, we've got a straight zombie narrative. And it works incredibly well because of that. And right up to that point, and I don't know whether they thought they were going to do a straight zombie movie and the extra plot points came along after production had been started, remembering that this was a 4-year production, or whether it was in the script from the start, I just simply don't know. But either way, that hard yards of doing this thing every on the weekends over 4 years really works for the film. Because when the plot twists happen, we buy into them for some reason. They're well displayed. They happen in an interesting way. And they really are interesting plot twists as well, which is never a bad thing. Now, one of the other characters we have in the film, apart from Brooke and Barry, is an actor that I've seen previously in a movie called Stone Brothers, which is an Indigenous Australian road trip comedy, which is really good, from about 2005. And that's Leon Burchell as Benny, who's another survivor. Now, Leon Burchell, he's got a good touch with comedy. He's an Indigenous Australian guy. He's not athletic at all. He's got a round face and he's a little bit chubby, but he really is good in this film. He's the comic relief in a sense, but again, he's a character with his own backstory, and he's telling there's a little bit of a flashback thing where everybody's telling their story of how they survived the apocalypse when everybody's in the garage, and Benny is the first person that tells his story, how he was out in the bush with his two relatives, and then the zombie apocalypse happened and what happened during that. And Leon Burchell puts that across really well, and I like him in this movie as well. And he plays really well with Jay Gallagher's Barry. There's a nice chemistry between the characters. And there are other people in there as well. There's another survivor called Chalker. There's Keith Aegis playing a guy called Frank, who's an older guy with a big handlebar moustache, who owns the garage that they're holed up in the workshop. And he's kind of old school, slightly older, working class guy, who's a bit of a machine, you know, a bit of a rev head. He's into machinery, he's into welding, he's into drinking a beer, and he's a kind of good Australian bloke. And Frank's a lot of fun in this movie as well. But the trailer gives away the first one of the two plot twists, and I'm only going to give you one of the two, and I'm not going to kind of over tell you what happens because of it. Now, as the zombie apocalypse evolves, something happens to the physical world in one very specific sense. Flammable liquids are no longer flammable. The guys try to light some petrol in a small jar, and it doesn't light, so they can't get the cars going. The cars simply won't run because they don't have a fuel source. And then quite by accident, Benny, Barry, and Frank discover that during the daytime, the zombies exhale a gas which is flammable. And so they rig up the ute that they're driving with a zombie with a face mask on so that the zombie's exhalation can fuel the car. So then we get into Mad Max territory there, because they've got a car fueled by zombie breath ripping down the highway as they're trying to get to where Brooke is, or where they think Brooke is, while these scientists are experimenting on her. And that's a lovely little conceit. It's very much becomes a Mad Max type movie, because in order to get the car, which is outside the garage, while they're surrounded by zombies, the guys have to cover themselves in makeshift armor, arm themselves with weapons, and end up looking like the bad guys in Mad Max 2, because they're wearing masks, they're wearing armor, they've got spikes everywhere, they've got baseball bats and cricket bats and shotguns and all sorts of shit. And there's a nice little nod there to George Miller's classic Australian road movie, which is kind of cool, and it doesn't come across as kind of derivative. It comes across as more, yeah, kind of thing. And I like that as well, that the fact that they do have these nods to other genre works, not necessarily in the same genre, but there are these three guys tooling along the back roads in the bush in a zombie-powered ute. Now, you got just that alone should be worth the price of admission if you're going to kick this movie out, and I hope you do. It is a lot of fun. Now, there is a second thing which is really well done and really interesting, which has to do with the experiments that are conducted on Brooke and the way that she escapes from this fucking bugfuck mad scientist who, had he thought of it, will be making human centipede zombies. He's that mad. He's really, really a fucked up human being in a fucked up world. And he's played by an actor called Baron Schwartz. And Baron Schwartz does a really nice job, given the fact that he's got to wear a hazmat suit through the whole of his acting role in this one. Now, I'm not going to give you away what happens with Brooke and how Brooke escapes and the changes that are wrought on Brooke by the zombie apocalypse, but it's very cool stuff. And there's a nice ending too. I mean, it doesn't end on a large note. It ends with a small number of characters out in the bush. And it's a nice ending as well. It really does do things well. And there's some really great graphics too of fast daytime zombies running through the bush and leaping over tree stumps and things like that and attacking people. It really does come across a little bit, and this is not a bad thing, like an old Hollywood Western where the Indians are attacking the cowboys. It's got a lot of that feel to it, which is kind of cool. And remember, this was done on $160,000. They got together about another $12,000 for post-production and then some money for distribution and things like that by selling the rights to streaming video services and obviously the company that made the Blu-ray, which was, and I'm going to grab the Blu-ray again just to work that out. It's released by, he said, Studio Canal. So Studio Canal. So basically, this one was put together on a shoestring, but it gives you such a bang for its buck. I've seen movies that cost 100 times as much as this and maybe a tenth as good. It really does bring you along. At the start, you're a little bit disjointed, thinking, what the fuck are these guys doing? Because there's a little bit of a flash forward at the start showing you the zombies. You think, what the fuck are these guys doing? And why are they running out of a garage, kitted up in armor, shooting zombies? Where did that come from? Right at the start of the film. But it works. Now, I want to see more from the Roach Turner brothers. I hope they get enough money and enough kudos together to really get a career going. Because what they're doing here is as good as the Sperry brothers did with their first movie, Undead. And I want to see more from these guys. They've got good screenwriting skills. They really know where to point a camera and at what. The production values are pretty good for the budget of this movie. Even the scientific equipment kind of works in context, even though a lot of it's old keyboards and little graphics things. And they did get some really fine acting out of some actors that we don't necessarily know. I know a lot of the actors in the movie have done a lot of television and a lot of soap opera kind of television here in Australia, but I really think they've got skills. And particularly the three lead characters, in a way, Jay Gallagher, Bianca Brady and Liam Birchall, are actors that I want to see a lot more of. I really like them too. I like Keith Aegis in there as well. But, this movie, this zombie movie is a lot of fun. It has those twists and turns. It got an 80% on Rotten Tomatoes, which for a first feature film is pretty damn good. And, it's such a shame that this movie, even though, of course, piracy does get a movie known to people and does get the name and the work of directors and writers and actors and everything like that out in the public, and the big problem isn't piracy but anonymity. In this case, I'd like to see these guys rewarded for what they do, because I really did enjoy it. I didn't expect to. At the start, I thought, oh yeah, another gore fest, another splatter fest with zombies and that kind of thing. But then the twists came along, and the characters and the resourcefulness of the characters, particularly Barry and Brooke, is really cool. They think their way through problems, and when monstrously what the fuck things happen to them, they use their smarts as much as anything else to find their way through it. And I like that. I like movies, as I said before, I love movies where people think their way out of problems rather than just blasting their way out of problems. I like smarts. Yes, it is nice to see things get blown away, but it's much nicer to see people who are smarter than the bad guys and who really show that the best things that human beings do is think their way through problems, which is, of course, again, is a theme that turns up in Age of Ultron, where even though science is the problem, science fixes the problem as well. And I like that. I like the fact that they don't run away from rationality and they don't run away from using their brains just because shit gets a bit nasty. But there's not much else to say about Wormwood. Doesn't have any nudity in it. It has strong female characters, at least one of them. Probably two if you count Barry's wife. And it's really a good, honest piece of film. It's a working-class zombie movie. It's got a strong Indigenous character in it, in Leon Birchall's Benny, who stays, you know, when he does his narrative at the start about what happens during the apocalypse, he does do it as an Indigenous man. And the way he describes things is as an Indigenous man. He describes the meteorites as Mimin lights and things like that. So I like the fact that they went with that kind of casting in the movie, because you don't see enough Indigenous actors getting a gig in mainstream or even genre Australian film. So I really appreciate that they did that. And he is good. He's not just there as a token. He's very much a strong actor in a strong role, and he does it very, very well. But anyway, that's about it for that one, and that's about it for this time around on the podcast. Again, I'd like to thank all of the Patreon subscribers, and we've got two new ones for the credits, which I haven't rolled into the credits yet because I've been, unfortunately, busy. And those new credits, which I will tell you before I play the credit reel, which I'm going to have to update. Tammy is going to be our donut wrangler, and Tim is going to be... I've lost what Tim's credit is going to be, so at the moment he's going to be Muse until I hear otherwise. And of course, there's Paul White, who is our special makeup effects dude. So anyway, look after yourselves. Keep watching the skies. I'll be back in 2 weeks with another Martian Drive-In, in a week with another Paleo Cinema podcast. And here are the podcast credits in the style of movie credits. So thank you to all of the Patreon campaign subscribers who put a couple of bucks in and help out the podcast. First off, I'm going to go this at random. So first off, we have Tom the Focus Puller, Sarah the Special Effects Technician, Ian the Caterer, Grant the Technicolor Consultant, Claire the Script Doctor, Gary the Prop Master, Morris the Musical Director, Jan the Dialect Coach, Armin the Key Grip, Matt the Rattlesnake Wrangler, Elaine the Scientific Advisor, Julia the Casting Director, Chris the Camera Operator, Christopher the Gaffer, Miss Jane the Wardrobe Mistress, Tansy the Foley Artist, Alyssa the Location Scout, Mark the Second Unit Director, and Paul the Special Makeup Effects Director. So thank you very much to all of the supporters of the podcast. You help this out a lot, and it really is appreciated. And of course, as usual, thank you to Mr. Claude Debussy for playing the music.